Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. Tuesday, July 29th. A quick reminder that tonight, the Lansing State Journal's Elaine Culhannock and I will be moderating a candidate forum that will include the four Democratic candidates for the 8th Congressional District. That takes place starting at 7:30 tonight at Central United Methodist Church in downtown Lansing. The candidates are the organizers. They want to make clear that invitations have been extended to both Mike Bishop and to Tom McMillan, the two Republican candidates for the primary, not in their party. Tom McMillan had a previous event planned. He is unable to join us, and we have not heard back from Mike Bishop. So it may well be the four Dems, but that's full speed ahead with Eric Schertzing, Ken Darga, Susan Grettenberger, and Jeffrey Hank tonight. And participant questions are welcome here if you get them to us before 7:30 p.m. tonight. Just show up a few minutes early. Central United Methodist Church, downtown North Capitol Avenue, downtown Lansing, 7:30 to 9 o'clock. Hope you can join us if it is of interest. Later on this hour, I'll point out State Rep Tom McMillan, one of the Republican candidates for the 8th District, not on the GOP side, will be joining us. We had Mike Bishop on yesterday. Today, Tom McMillan. At the top of our program today, about a dozen Michigan charter school authorizers from around the state journeyed to Lansing yesterday. They met with State School Superintendent Michael Flanagan about more vigorous oversight of the state's charter schools. Earlier this month, Mr. Flanagan warned that he would use his authority to hold authorizers more accountable for the operation of charter schools. He has emphasized the need for greater transparency along with stronger oversight of finances and academics. He also warned authorizers that he would stop the expansion of charters by authorizers who don't provide such oversight. Our next guest was in attendance at that gathering yesterday. Brad Weaver is policy director at the John Engler Center for Charter Schools at Central Michigan University. CMU authorizes 64 charter schools around the state. Brad Weaver, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
For our listeners who pay less attention to the charter school landscape here in Michigan, remind us of the role that authorizers play. Every charter school has an authorizer. Tell us about that.
That's correct. Under Michigan statute, there are four different organizations that are allowed to authorize charter schools. Those would be local school districts, intermediate school districts, community colleges, or the 15 public universities. In their role as an authorizer, they issue charter contracts to applicants after going through a rigorous application process. And they hold these schools accountable to the provisions within that performance contract.
Okay.
There's very specific educational goals that are laid out within the contract. And our statutory responsibility is to oversee that school's compliance with all applicable law and the terms of their charter contract.
And we'll point out the great majority of charter schools here in Michigan are authorized by a group of, I would say, three of you. Three colleges, Central Michigan University, where you're at, Grand Valley State University, and Bay Mills Community College up in the UP?
I believe the three largest authorizers authorize about, it's over half of the schools where students, it's the schools where over half of the students, charter school students, attend.
Well, to get to yesterday's meeting, it reportedly involved proposed procedures that would involve suspending an authorizer. What did MDE put on the table yesterday as far as any kind of framework for moving forward with this?
Well, let's give a little bit of background first. The superintendent, Mike Flanagan, has had this statutory authority to suspend an authorizer's ability to authorize new charter schools if he has determined that they're not providing ongoing oversight, the necessary ongoing oversight of those schools. What we haven't seen to date is the process or how that would be determined that an authorizer has not been fulfilling their statutory responsibilities. Yesterday's meeting was about what that process would be, how the superintendent would go about determining whether an authorizer has fulfilled their responsibilities or not, ultimately to lead to that decision, potentially, of suspending an authorizer's authority to issue new contracts or to renew existing contracts.
So the process that started is about a more detailed identification of the criteria, really, behind a possible suspension.
That's
correct. Do I understand what you're saying?
That's correct. And we the meeting was very productive. We felt it was a very good conversation with the superintendent. We took the opportunity to tell the story of Central Michigan University and the standards that we have established over the past 20 years. It's this year we celebrate our 20th anniversary of authorizing our first school. Over the years, we have developed best practices, policies, processes that have been a model for other authorizers in Michigan and across the country. About 10 years ago, we helped establish the Michigan Council of Charter School Authorizers. And through that, we established some oversight and accountability standards that we live and operate under.
Earlier this month, Superintendent Flanagan emphasized a number of standards that come from the National Association of Charter School Authorizers, and he mentioned several standards whereby the governing boards of charter schools need to provide oversight where too often it appears the management companies are providing that oversight. How much of the meeting yesterday addressed that topic?
I would say that specific topic was not discussed in great detail. The standards by which that you're referring to by the National Association of Charter School Authorizers was mentioned as you know, is this a framework that we could use that Michigan authorizers could use to operate under? The specifics within there, we didn't really get into that type of detail, but I want to make sure something's clear here. Here's the structure of charter schools: is you have an authorizer, the four organizations that I mentioned earlier, they issue a performance contract to a nonprofit board that is appointed by that authorizer. That is a local school board that is responsible for the daily operations of that school.
So you at the Engler Center do that. You're involved in that function.
We do not operate schools. We do not oversee the day-to-day operations of charter schools.
But what relationship do the authorizers have with the boards?
Our relationship with that charter school board is through our performance contract.
Okay. So can we fairly assume that the meeting yesterday was maybe the beginning of a much longer discussion? This is an ongoing discussion.
There's definitely going to be more meetings to come. This was a great first step towards having this conversation. CMU has been very open, and we appreciate the superintendent focusing on high quality schools. That's something that we have been committed to and have strived for the past 20 years. We think we've done some great work to move towards that, and we appreciate having the conversation with the superintendent.
Brad Weaver is our guest. He's policy director at the Engler Center for Charter Schools at Central Michigan University. CMU authorizes 64 charter schools around the state. You told me how many students are enrolled.
Just under 31,000.
31,000 charter school students in Michigan attend schools authorized by the Engler Center at CMU. Brad, are you aware of charter schools in Michigan where the management company enjoys oversight at the expense of what should be an independent board? Do you feel this is happening?
As I explained before, our role as an authorizer, we have a relationship with that board, with the board of directors that's responsible for that operation, the operation of that school. That board has the opportunity to contract with whatever entity that they choose to fulfill the terms of the contract that we have with them. If they choose to contract with a management company, that is their choice. We, as an authorizer, provide them with tools and information and resources to hold that management company accountable. We feel we issue annual reports that cover the academic, financial, and operational aspects of the school. That is a very open and transparent way for us to communicate how we feel that the school is doing. But it's ultimately up to that board to determine if their management structure, whatever that looks like, whether it's a management company or they hire a school leader directly to operate the school, it's up to that board to determine how best to fulfill the terms of their charter contract. Our role is with that board, and whatever that structure looks like, we're looking for results. We feel like we've got some positive results.
But do you hear from some of the boards that you work with that who are fearful that the management companies have been assigned too much leeway, too much authority, too much decision-making authority?
That would be a board member's responsibility to rein them in. They ultimately, that board member holds the power to hold that management company or whatever entity is out there accountable for results. So they hold that power. They have the ability to say, ABC service company, you're not fulfilling the terms of the contract that we have with you. We'd like to go in a different direction.
Are there charter school authorizers in Michigan who should not be authorizing charter schools?
I can't comment on that. I can only comment on what CMU is doing and simply say that we've established some high standards for authorizing in Michigan. We live by those, and we are more than happy to share the best practices and the policies that we have developed over the past 20 years. And if anybody has ever needed any help or assistance, our door is always open. We frequently get visited by authorizers from across the country. We met with some folks from Idaho that are just getting into authorizing a couple months ago. So we're more than willing to share what we've learned and what we've developed. We feel that we've got some pretty good systems in place.
You feel like you've got standards that other authorizers might derive a benefit from.
Absolutely.
Superintendent Flanagan referred to earlier this month rooting out the bad actors, which is a pretty unflattering way to refer to people who are charged with educating young people. You're not seeing or hearing about problems with other authorizers and their oversight?
There's been some things that have been brought up in the news media lately.
Well, the Free Press article really was something of a game changer. The overall impact of that, it put the whole charter school landscape under quite a microscope.
I think part of the issue with the series of articles that ran about a month ago is it really took all charter schools and charter school authorizers and painted them with a very broad brush. It took a couple of instances of local mismanagement and some other issues and really painted the entire charter school sector as problematic. It failed to point out some clear areas where CMU provided information to the reporters about some issues that we had actually uncovered in our oversight process that we have. They reported on those. They failed to report that all of those issues were addressed in a very quick and timely manner. So all of the things that we've seen out there, we feel that again, we have systems and processes that are in place to address and make sure that schools are following the law and the terms of their charter contract.
But is the larger charter school landscape in Michigan transparent enough? That seemed to be the major takeaway of the Free Press series.
Well, let's be clear about something here. Charter schools are public schools, and they are required to follow the same laws, rules, regulations as traditional public schools are, including all transparency requirements. And that's the Open Meetings Act, Freedom of Information Act, the charter school statute. Unfortunately, I don't think a lot of people have read the statute. When the law was changed in 2011, there were actually 64 new transparency and reporting requirements that were added to the law that required further disclosure for charter schools. Unfortunately, those things were not mentioned.
Are you suggesting that the conversation that Superintendent Flanagan wants to have with charter school authorizers is largely unnecessary?
I wouldn't say that it's unnecessary. I think it's a good conversation to have. I think any time we can have a conversation about raising the bar and setting higher standards is a great conversation, and we look forward to being a part of that.
I want to ask you about families. I mean, are you hearing from any of the schools that you authorize that might be scrutinizing charter schools more closely in the aftermath of the Free Press article?
I can't comment specifically on any specific stories from parents that we've heard. I think if you read some of the letters to the editor and the different things that have been put out there, I think you'll see that some parents are pretty upset at the mischaracterization of the schools that their students attend. We have to remember, nobody has to attend a charter school. Parents are making a choice to send their children to these schools. That's a really important choice. I have three kids of my own, it's a very tough decision of where you would like your kids to be educated. And when somebody attacks that and somebody, you know, calls into question a major decision that you've made as a family or as a parent for your student or for your child, I think people were right in being a little upset at the way that charter schools were characterized across the board.
Well, this is just part of an ongoing and very vigorous conversation about education in the state of Michigan. We look forward to continuing it, and we want to thank you for joining us here today. Brad Weaver, Policy Director of the John Engler Center for Charter Schools at Central Michigan University. Thanks, Brad.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. At the end of each month, we check in with Great Lakes commentator and journalist Gary Wilson for updates on environmental stories from around the Great Lakes Basin. For today's month in review, we're focusing on the Detroit water shutoffs and the latest legal news on the Asian carp front. Gary Wilson, welcome back.
Hey, Mark. Good morning. And that was quite a discussion you guys had going there.
Well, education in Michigan, not just Michigan, but education all over the country there's dozens of different conversations going on at the same time that are all really important. And certainly the charter school landscape here in Michigan is just one of them. So
I think your closing remark there was kind of serve as a good lead-in, talking about continuing the dialogue, and I'll get to that in a few minutes.
Okay. We have our own continuing dialogues to talk about.
Yeah.
The Detroit water shutoff story has been getting national, even international, attention. Bring us up to speed on what is happening there.
Sure, Mark. I think the facts are pretty well known. As you mentioned, it's been getting a lot of media exposure, national, international attention, and that is the fact that Detroit, over the years, the city of Detroit has allowed people sort of on a de facto basis to not pay their bills, and many people are not financially able to pay their bills. There's a small group that just don't pay them because they've been able to get away with it. And this also includes some corporations who are delinquent. It's just not citizens. But as Detroit's preparing to emerge from bankruptcy, they need to get their financial house in order. So they've launched an aggressive program to discontinue service for people who are delinquent a certain amount of months and a certain dollar amounts. And this is water. This isn't, your cell phone service or some other peripheral thing. This is water that's needed for you know, basic sanitation and for drinking water sustains life. So that garners people attention, garners people's attention, and especially in a city like Detroit, which is so economically disadvantaged right now, and these are mostly poor people, and that gets a spotlight put on it.
People might not see this as an environmental story, though, so much as an economic story. How is it you see it as an environmental issue?
Well, I think, Mark, that it's at the nexus, the juncture of where the environment, water, meets the social issues and meets the economic issues. None of these stand alone. We talk a lot in the environmental communities about, you know, water being related to the economy and how right now in Michigan and other places, you know, a blue economy where, you know, water can be used as an you know, as an asset to, you know, to help to sustain economies. And I think what we're seeing here in Detroit is the merging of social issues related to water. You know, water issues don't stop at the shoreline. They go both ways. You know, and you know, Detroit is smack dab in the middle of the Great Lakes region. Michigan is the Great Lakes state. You know, Michigan's always going to have a spotlight on it when it comes to water, how it's managed. And now the social issues here have definitely crept into the conversation. And I think there needs to be a broader conversation. And I reached out this past week to a number of the organizations to mostly located in Michigan to get their thoughts on this, environmental organizations, and the responses were interesting.
Tell us more about that. What kind are environmental organizations weighing in on this thing? What did you hear?
Well, they're very cautious. Environmental organizations. First of all, the Sierra Club, the Michigan State chapter of the Sierra Club, has been involved on a local basis for a number of years. So good for them. They've been working in the community, helping people. It hasn't gotten a lot of publicity, but the Sierra Club has been active for quite some time. Other Great Lakes environmental organizations have not been involved, at least not so it's been visible. So I reached out to the Alliance for the Great Lakes here in Chicago, and they do Great Lakes advocacy work. They really stepped back. They didn't want anything to do with the Detroit water issue. They say that their mission is focused on just the ecological restoration of the Great Lakes and other bodies of water, and they sort of see it stopping right at the shoreline. National Wildlife Federation, however, the Great Lakes office located in Ann Arbor, I had a conversation there with Jordan Lebetkin. He's their senior media guy, and he sent what I thought was a very interesting and powerful statement. They see water as a human right. They do see the need to engage water as a social issue. They think that the government needs to work to protect the water rights at all levels, and they recognize the inequities, and they hope that Detroit can find a resolution that gives the citizens access to water. Now, that's all high-level stuff, and, you know, when the rubber meets the road, is how do you do all that? But I thought that that statement was excellent, a good place to start a discussion that needs to take place in the region.
We're talking with Gary Wilson on our Great Lakes Month in Review segment here on WKAR's Current State. July also saw another ruling in the Asian carp court saga. Tell us about that.
Yes, Mark. Michigan and Michigan and four other states, but Michigan is the lead state in the suit against the Army Corps of Engineers in Chicago's Water District, trying to get the courts to take some action to on the advance of Asian carp. And this suit, in some form, has been going on for at least 3 or 4 years. But an appeals court just a couple of weeks ago dismissed Michigan's case, and they said that Michigan had failed to offer facts that the defendants, the Army Corps and Chicago's Water District, were operating waterways in a manner that would allow Asian carp to get into the lake. The court did say that Michigan could revisit the issue if they could present a new set of facts, but this is another legal defeat for Michigan and the other states, and right now their options are not good.
Candidly, Gary, is there really anything meaningful that can happen at this point on the carp question. I mean, even if a total separation of the Great Lakes from the waterways that carry the carp were green-lighted tomorrow, it would take decades to build, would it not?
You're talking. The biggest solution is in that 15 to 20 year range. Shorter solutions are in the, I don't know, the 3 to 5 year range, and many people think even those would not be enough. So, right now there are just no really good options. But if you listen to what the court said, they've said that what the Army Corps of Engineers is doing now with the barriers and fish kills and other things is working. That's where we are, and I don't know where this is going to go, and I certainly don't think it's going to go anyplace quickly.
This week, there was another development in the increasing scrutiny of the Enbridge oil pipeline up at the Mackinac Straits. Attorney General Bill Schuette says that the pipeline does not comply with state regulations and needs to have additional anchors installed to support it. What does this mean?
Well, I think Michigan has been under a tremendous amount of pressure, including Governor Snyder, from a number of groups, but primarily environmental groups, have really taken up the cause of getting scrutiny on this pipeline, this Enbridge pipeline that runs through the Straits of Mackinac. And, you know, in Michigan, Enbridge rings a bell because of the Kalamazoo spill a few years ago. So the governor has asked the AG, the Attorney General Bill Schuette, to get involved, and also directed that Dan Wyant, the head of Michigan's Department of Environmental Quality, engage with Enbridge, and they did. They sent off a letter to Enbridge and asked him about these additional supports that may be needed. Enbridge has agreed to put those additional supports in, but that's not going to satisfy people. Especially environmental groups, and back to the National Wildlife Federation, the Great Lakes Office, they want a full inspection, and they want to see a plan to replace the 60-year-old pipeline. So I think this is a first step, and Schuette and Wyant have both said that this isn't the end of their inquiries with Enbridge. So, again, this is another one that's going to play out over time.
Gary Wilson is a Great Lakes commentator and journalist. Gary, thanks for your time. Always enlightening.
Hey, Mark. Good to be with you.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. We are just 1 week away from the primary election here in Michigan, which means it's the home stretch for candidates vying for their party's nominations to succeed, amongst others, Congressman Mike Rogers in our 8th Congressional District. Yesterday, we spoke with Republican candidate Mike Bishop about how he'd represent the district in Washington. Now we turn to his competition for the Republican nomination, State Representative Tom McMillan. Tom McMillan is a certified public accountant whose political experience includes being mayor of Auburn Hills and an Oakland County commissioner. He's also been a state representative since 2008 and is currently chair of the House Oversight Committee and co-chair of the Joint Committee on Administrative Rules. Tom McMillan, welcome back to Current State.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Why do you want to be our congressman? What made you get into this?
Well, I mean, our country's in real trouble with the debt and deficit, with Obamacare, with the general overreach of the federal government. And I just see too many Republicans going there and just kind of folding into the Washington way. And we need, there's a, you know, group like Justin Amash and others who are really standing up to both parties and the establishment and really saying, you know, let's deal with these debt and deficit. Let's not window dress. Let's make some tough decisions. Let's get the government, the federal government, out of a lot of the policy decisions like education, Common Core, push it all back down to the states. There's just a real, and just kind of the lawlessness and the treating us all like criminals with the NSA spying and gathering data on all of us. There's a, you know, there's a real point right now where, you know, we've got to make serious decisions and start getting power out of Washington.
Talk to us about your highest priorities if you were successful. What would be the issues you'd like to focus on most?
Well, it really is getting the federal government out, getting them just so much, a lot less power. I mean, whether it's Obamacare, that needs to go back to the states, whether it's education, whether it's welfare, you know, send these policy decisions back down to the states, closer to the people. You know, Washington has so much money in the politics, and I'm seeing that right now in my campaign. My opponent's raising a lot of money from the establishment sources in Washington, but there's so much money and so much corruption because there's so much power in Washington, and we need legislators that are not going there to just kind of go along to get along, but really, you know, push this power out of Washington and back down to the states. So that's, you know, whether it's Common Core, I think I, you know, and the federal government and their overreach into education, I think that's a left-right coalition there that's just ready for somebody like myself to help step up and pull it together. You know, we're debating teacher evaluations in Lansing, and one of the big debates is, will Washington be satisfied with how Mrs. Jones at the third grade elementary school is being evaluated? I mean, it's just ridiculous how the federal government is overreaching.
We're talking with Tom McMillan, candidate for the GOP 8th Congressional District primary nomination. What makes you a better candidate for the 8th than Mike Bishop?
Well, I mean, I just have a very solid conservative record. I'm somebody who, you know, has taken the tough decisions, whether it was eliminating the Michigan business tax, which we call the Mike Bishop tax. It was the job-killing MBT. We took those votes and got rid of it. I'm a leader in transparency. I just got a Michigan Press Association award, you know, for all my work on Freedom of Information Act reform and for my transparency efforts. You know, I stand up whether it's, the overreach of the NSA. I've been fighting surveillance of our citizens here in Michigan. You know, I took the lead on Obamacare, trying to stop it. I crisscrossed the state back a few years ago, trying to get signatures to get a repeal or a opt out on the ballot. We got a couple hundred thousand signatures, but I'm somebody who really takes action. I don't just sit around. Whether it was Common Core, we stopped it last year, defunded it in the budget, even though the governor thought it was very important. We had a very strong debate. And, you know, right now we're out of the federal testing because of a lot of the work that I led on last year. And so it's, you know, we need somebody that senses the urgency and really will take action.
Where you alluded to the transparency issue here a minute ago. The incumbent, Mike Rogers, has been highly critical of government whistleblowers, especially ones like Edward Snowden, who impact national security. How do you view the actions of Edward Snowden?
Well, certainly anything that he did illegal, if he, you know, released documents that truly were not something he should be held accountable for that. But he certainly brought to light things that were, you know, not being told to the American people. And, you know, the Mr. Clapper, the NSA director, certainly lied to the American people when he said that there's not mass data gathering. And I've got resolution calling on Congress to prosecute him for lying to Congress. Certainly, like I said, he should be held accountable, but nonetheless, he certainly revealed a lot of things that should have been revealed by our own government, but they were keeping it from us.
You referred to Obamacare here a few minutes ago. Would you join future efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act?
Absolutely. You know, we just need to send it back to the states. If a state like Massachusetts wants to try RomneyCare, which was a more socialized system, they should be free to do that. But I think they're going to pay the consequences when businesses and citizens want a more free market, you know, a lot more freedom in their health care. But nonetheless, states should be able to, it has to get back to the people. If we have problems with health care, you don't want somebody having to go to Washington. It's a lot easier to go to Lansing and your state representative and try and argue for change as opposed to the behemoth there in Washington.
Well, with the skyrocketing health care costs, though, and tens of millions of Americans doing without health insurance, how do you recommend we address those? How do those get addressed?
Well, the skyrocketing cost is only getting worse since Obamacare, and we know central planning doesn't work. I mean, we have people that are paying for a lot of mandates in Obamacare that they have no, 60-year-old couples having to pay for maternity care and other things. I mean, it's just, when you do central planning, you do it very poorly. The free market is the best system. We know that that it's going to, we just need to look at the VA and the disaster that they're, how they're treating our veterans to know that Obamacare and central planning for health care is not going to be the direction we should be going in.
How do you work with colleagues across the aisle if you are elected? How do you regard the Democrats here in solving some of these seemingly intractable problems?
Well, talk to people in Lansing. I work with Democrats all the time. I work with the MEA when we're dealing from time to time when we're dealing with local control issues on education. I work with others on due process, whether it's reforming the civil asset forfeiture laws here in Michigan, or some of the license plate readers and things that are intrusive that the government's doing. I work with Democrats regularly on issues where my principles align with theirs. I find I have more in common with true liberals as opposed to progressives, but I certainly work with the other side quite well.
Tom McMillan is our guest. He's a candidate for the GOP nomination for 8th District Congressman, one of the hottest hot-button issues in Michigan right now in the nation is the future of tens of thousands of young asylum seekers who've shown up at our southern border in recent months. Here in Lansing, which you would represent if you were successful here, there's the beginning of an effort to allow some of these asylum seekers to the capital city. What do you make of that?
Well, right now, the power of the legislature has in Washington has somewhat been relegated or removed, because the real power is in the budget and continuing resolutions. Democrats don't actually pass budgets anymore. It's been almost 5 years since the Senate has done that, but they do pass continuing resolutions and debt ceiling increases, and that's where that could be dealt with. If next week we had a CR vote, a continuing resolution, I guarantee you that truly securing the border and stopping the invasion, not just of the, they're not just children. There's a lot of young adults that are coming over and with their parents, by the way. We would be able to deal with that. But right now, the administration, certainly if there's anything illegal that they're doing, in transporting these kids to our state, I would encourage and have been encouraging the Attorney General to, file a lawsuit. But it's a real problem, but we have to first make sure that we secure the borders, and then we have to change the incentives. If Obama wants money to process these kids and then figure out what to do with them, we should take that away from his vacation budgets, which is enormous, and things that he values, so that there's an incentive to not have more and more people come across the border. But it's hard to have this debate when the floodgates are still open. I mean, we've got to get serious about securing the border, eliminating a lot of the handouts that we give people that are here illegally, whether it's welfare, health care, education. We've got to really deal with the incentives.
Is this situation with the Central American, mostly kids here, I mean, is this a situation, is this more a refugee issue or is this more an immigration issue?
Well, I mean, it really appears to be, I guess you'd have to look at each case individually, but it seems that there's a real concerted effort to, all of a sudden, thousands show up on our border when they hadn't been in the past. So I really think that it seems to be a concerted effort. With our policies regarding anchor babies and, people becoming citizens based on their children, I mean, I think that the incentives are wrong, and we can't just paint with a broad brush. There may be some that are here for asylum, but we need to secure the border, not have them going throughout the United States, and we need to just keep them right there at the border and deal with those issues one on one.
The Wilberforce Act is relevant here from back in 2008, which was signed into law by President George Bush. And the Wilberforce Act apparently was meant to address illegal trafficking, but apparently one of the unintended consequences has been this flood of young asylum seekers. What role and the president apparently wants to alter this Wilberforce Act, along with generate an awful lot of money to try to alleviate this situation. Do you understand what the Wilberforce Act is, and is it relevant?
Well, yeah, I mean, if it's, like you said, there's a lot of unintended consequences. Things sound good, but if you don't dig into it and understand what you're voting on, I see that all the time, and I'm being criticized for not voting for something that was a 22-page bill that, you know, we were given 2 minutes to vote on in this campaign. But that's what you end up with, is a lot of a good-sounding bill that ends up with a lot of unintended consequences. So, yeah, that the Wilberforce Act needs to change, and make sure that it's clear that incentives for kids that are not, needing asylum or not being harmed, you know, that we can't just have the floodgates open for anybody just to come in. We're seeing the consequences of that unintended consequence or of that law.
Tom McMillan, if you were elected, would you sign the Norquist pledge?
I have signed it, and I think the federal government is way too large, and I don't think there's any reason for additional money to go to Washington. Again, I think we need to push it out and back to the states. I mean, if welfare wasn't left up to the states, I assure you that California would be much more careful if there's undocumented or illegal immigrants that were on their welfare. They'd be a lot more careful if their taxpayers actually had to pay for it. But unfortunately, my children and grandchildren are. So, yes.
Most of the polls have you trailing your challenger, Mike Bishop. What do you have planned for this final week to try to make up ground?
Well, we're seeing that there's a lot of excitement on the ground. The one poll that was out there is a robo poll. I've seen polls go from, swing wildly when you got robo polls out there. So we feel that we have a lot of engaged and excited voters who will see the opportunity to send somebody who is not a go-along to get-along person, that has really got the history of standing up to both parties and really making tough decisions. And, really fighting against big government. And so we see that they're excited. We've got, we're still getting our message out. We're still got a lot of volunteers. We've got a lot of people on the ground, a lot more than my opponent. So we feel that the momentum is going to carry us and that they're going to be excited to get out there to vote.
Tom McMillan is a state representative from Oakland County and a candidate for the GOP nomination to represent Lansing and East Lansing in the 8th District here in Michigan in Congress. We all head to the polls 1 week from today. Tom McMillan, good luck. Thanks for joining us.
All right. It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And a reminder that tonight in downtown Lansing, the Lansing State Journal's Elaine Kulhanek and I will moderate a debate with the four Democratic candidates for the congressional nod from the 8th District. Join us starting at 7:30. Every so often, Michigan's rattlesnake population makes it into the news. And today is one of those days. Michigan is home to the eastern Massasauga rattlesnake. Never seen one. Not that wild about seeing one, but a young girl was bitten by one recently, according to reports. This was at an Ann Arbor Botanical Garden. She is okay now after she was treated at the hospital. And Michigan naturalists are taking the occasion to comment about the importance of respecting Michigan's rattlesnake population. I guess it's easy to forget we have rattlesnake. We have one rattlesnake, I believe, in Michigan. The eastern Massasauga rattlesnake lives throughout the state, mainly where wetlands and hilly areas meet. Noted. Its current state here on 90.5 WKAR, Lake Superior Magazine's September issue will include its annual Best of the Lake list. The article highlights reader favorites in dozens of categories, from best spectacular views to best boat ride to best fish sandwich and on. All winners are chosen from the Lake Superior states of Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, plus Ontario, Canada. WKAR's Peter Worf spoke with editor Connie LeMay, who first described the voting process.
We generally try to have certain categories repeated every year. We haven't in the past had the same. Some places do the same best of list over and over again, and we try to vary it up a little. But we do always try to talk about views and overlooks, because, of course, that's things that people are interested in when they're traveling around the lake. And then we also try to touch base on something for dining, lodging, or overnight stays, and generally shopping, too. So those are kind of repetitive categories that sometimes we do a slightly different take on. And then we had some new ones this year specific to art galleries and museums and to waterfalls.
Not a lot of surprises in the best spectacular views. Of course, pictured rocks. We also had Brockway Mountain up in the Keweenaw Peninsula.
Yeah, and some of the waterfronts, the Thunder Bay Waterfront and the Duluth Waterfront and Skyline Parkway and the Bayfield Waterfront all got first spectacular views, which I thought was great fun, because you often think of spectacular views as being kind of high up, where you have to kind of get that overview. But it is true, sometimes just on the shore side, you're getting some fantastic views.
How did the voting work?
This year we added an element in the travel guide. So we have a survey that's actually printed and attached in the magazine that people can take out, fill out, and then mail to us. And that appears in our travel guide and in our April-May issue. And then we also have online a survey that people could fill out if they prefer to do it that way. So they could either do it electronically or actually physically by mail.
And how many participated in the vote this year?
This year we got a little over 1,200 votes individually. And then, of course, for each of those, they're able to vote in each category. So we had 13 categories that we ended up with this year. And in each category, they're able to vote for Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Ontario. So each shore gets a take.
Right. This is Peter Wharf for Current State on WKAR. I'm speaking with Connie LeMay, the editor of Lake Superior Magazine, and we're talking about a recent issue, the upcoming issue, 2014 of September, the best of the 2014 lake winners. So, Connie, what were some of the surprises that you and some of the other staff saw from the voters? Were there many?
There are some things that we haven't tried that's always kind of fun to find. So, for instance, for Michigan, for Best Shop, we had Copper World in Calumet, with which I'm quite familiar, and it is just a great place if you're a shopper. It's a great place to go visit. For Best Shopping Experience, and you have to understand, I'm a shopper when I travel, too. So
okay.
For Best Shopping Experience, Downtown Marquette and Downtown Copper Harbor one, which I thought were just delightful. And I do find both of those great places to stroll. I like to stroll and browse local shops. And so it sounds like our readers are kind of on board with me there. One that shouldn't have been a surprise, but I thought was great fun, is for Best Family Attraction. Pictured Rocks, of course, was one of them, but also the Sioux Locks.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're being told that that's a great place to bring the family and to watch those boats as they basically go just right by you.
You know, the word awesome is thrown around just arbitrarily and in a lot of ways in a meaningless way, but the Sioux Locks are a truly awesome sight.
They are, and you know, it's unique almost in its own way. It's not like you can get that experience anywhere. And it's certainly unique to Lake Superior because the Sioux Locks and the proximity to the boats. In Duluth here, we do have the piers where boats come close by as they're going through the piers. But, yeah, the locks is quite a unique experience.
Yeah. Will you tell me about some of your other personal favorites in the Lake Superior, Upper Great Lakes area?
I did love the waterfalls. The Tequamenon Falls and Bond Falls were best waterfalls in Michigan. I can tell you a fun story about Bond Falls. People who are familiar with Bond Falls are often familiar with the spectacular colors that are reflected in the water because the water is so deeply dark. And when those brilliant fall leaves come out, Bond Falls, it just has this wonderful reflection of these fantastic colors. And one year I was delighted because we had a reader who said, well, that can't be true colors with the photo that we had of Bonn Falls in the fall. But yes, indeed, that is the true colors of that waterfall in the autumn.
Can you describe that?
Well, I can. The water is very dark, and I think it's probably from the tannins in the water as it comes down. And so it's a dark, almost black water. It's very dark. Well, then you have these brilliant reds and yellows in the leaves and greens. An interesting mix of green gets in there as well. And then when you're looking, so many photographers know to take a photo of the water rather than of the trees, because there's this blend of these brilliant colors reflected from the leaves in this dark water. And it's absolutely spectacular. And it does seem like it's unreal because it's so beautiful.
You said earlier in the conversation that you have some new categories and then some categories that you like to come back to. What are some of the things that you might like to see next year in the next round of voting?
Next year, definitely, again, we're going to be talking about what's your favorite restaurant or place to eat, what's your favorite overnight stay. And often, this year we did best overnight stay, and this year we actually had lodgings that were mentioned. But the other fun thing about our readers is we never know if sometimes we ask for best overnight stay and they'll give us a campground,
right,
because that is their favorite. So it's just fun to see what kind of votes we actually get. The other one that we did this year that was kind of fun in terms of restaurants or lodging is we asked what's the best staff? So, you know, most hospitable or friendliest staff. And it was fun to see which locations got best staff in that area. In Michigan, it happened to be Fitzgerald's Restaurant, Eagle River, and Harbor House at Copper Harbor. And if I'm recalling correctly, at Harbor House, they actually greet the ferry as it comes in, the staff does. So I'm sure that's great fun.
Connie LeMay, editor of Lake Superior Magazine. We've been talking about the article Best of the 2014 Lake Winners. Connie, thanks so much.
Oh, well, thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, we'll look at whether tax breaks for corporations really pay off for towns and cities here in Michigan. We'll also feature the Veterans of Foreign Wars National Home for Children in Eaton Rapids. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Glad you could join us. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.